And good evening, I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. To commemorate World Refugee Day, tonight on the show, we shine a spotlight on a fundamental aspect of refugee rights, the right to work and secure meaningful employment. What are the key considerations and concerns that policymakers might have when it comes to granting permission for refugees to work in Malaysia? My first guest tonight is Tashni Sukumaran. She is a human rights consultant and researcher. Tashni, thank you for joining me on the show today. Can we begin with what is the current status in Malaysia? Are refugees allowed to work here?
Thanks for having me, Melissa. And this is a great topic. I'm so glad that you guys are touching on this. So with regards to right to work, so technically none. We have not signed the Refugee Convention. And there are very, very few rights accorded to refugees here. So not only are they not allowed to work, they are unable to access sort of public health care or public education systems, that sort of thing. There have been pilot projects in the past. I think a few years ago, 300 workers, like Rohingya workers, were brought into sort of a plantation and they were given permission to do so. I think even further back than that, maybe in 2017 or 16, they were talking about giving up permits to, again, a pilot project. I don't know if that actually went through because of the elections later on. There are also some working with NGOs to provide volunteer healthcare services. But in essence, the short answer is no, there is no legal right to work here.
But does that mean that refugees don't work? Are there refugees who work even though there is no legal right for them to secure employment here?
Yeah, so I think all of us have actually met refugees even in our day-to-day life who are working sort of informally and often in jobs that Malaysians don't want to take on, you know, sort of whether it's F&B, sort of customer-facing F&B or cleaning or construction and all these informal gigs sort of are what they have to turn to because there is no legal right to work. But that also results in vulnerabilities, precarity, and a lot of risk. The government has been talking about guidelines to allow refugees to work for a very long time, and it's over several administrations. And it's always about studying suitable sectors, and there's this idea of like, oh, how do you, what happens if they compete for work against Malaysians, against our citizens? But no one's actually had sort of the wherewithal to come in and say, you know what, we're going to start this project that is across sectors, that is across sending countries, and that we're going to allow them to work.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, a couple of things that you pointed out to, and I would like you to elaborate. When is that a legitimate concern? The concern that allowing refugees to work or granting permission the right to work means that they'll be competing for jobs from Malaysians?
Absolutely not. Like, it's such a tired xenophobic chestnut that's trotted out by people with obviously an agenda or just plain old racist. There are about, 180,000 refugees. When you factor in how many of these will be children, minors, that sort of thing, it's less than it's slightly over 1% of the workforce, right? Yes, they may be overrepresented in certain sectors because Malaysians don't want to do that job. But no, in no way is there competition. It will be just slightly over 1%. If anyone comes out saying, you know, it is going to be competition, it's going to take jobs away from Malaysians, it's just xenophobia that's fueling that kind of sentiment.
Okay, and you also mentioned that the government often studies what's quote-unquote suitable sectors. Can I ask you about that? Are there certain sectors as for, you know, that refugees should be allowed permission to work, or is that should it be a blanket permission? And which refugees should be allowed to work? Because again, we have refugees who are registered and those who are not.
I think all refugees and asylum seekers should be given the right to work, because without doing so, you put them in a worse situation, and it actually limits their ability to then potentially move on. Right? If Malaysia is so insistent that it doesn't want to be a host country or a destination country, then you should be able to empower people so that they can make their own choices later on. So no, I don't believe that there should be a specific sector or even specific classes or groups of refugees. But the tendency from policymakers has been to sort of lump them into things like plantation or construction, because once again, Malaysians don't want to do those jobs.
The pull factor factor argument has always been used. You know, the allowing refugees to work will open the floodgates, so to speak. That I've heard commonly associated with granting refugees the right to work legally. How do we make sense of that argument that's so often been used?
I also think that's another sort of red herring argument, because if you are facing sort of genocide, violence, sexual violence, you know, your children are at risk of, you know, torture or worse, there's no such idea as like, oh, this is a fantastic pull factor. It's all about the push factors when it comes to refugees and asylum seekers. So really it becomes a question of proportions, right? Like,
So you don't think that allowing refugees to work will open the floodgates?
No, I don't think that allowing refugees to work will open any kind of floodgates for immigration. Once again, refugees, displacement, it's all about the push factor. Very rarely is it about the pull factor.
Beyond the human rights argument, which is a compelling argument, what are the economic benefits of allowing a refugee to work in a host country?
So I have heard, of course, these economic arguments about, you know, sort of taxes and how once they start working, they'll contribute to the GDP. The figure that's commonly thrown around, I think to the tune of 3 billion. But I do think it still has to go back to that humanitarian argument of, you know, we don't lose anything. So why should we not? Especially because, and I think here is the real economic argument that we could make. Now there are new supply chain regulations coming into place, right, from the European Union mainly. And of course, other countries have a modern slavery act that they're sort of stepping up on. And these are very strict in terms of supply chain due diligence. If Malaysia does not step up, we are going to lose any global competitiveness we have, right? And that includes how we treat migrant workers and, of course, how we treat refugee workers, because they are in the supply chain, right? We do know companies that hire them sort of on the sly, because we do know they are working in the construction industry and similar. So if Malaysia doesn't clear up its supply chain with regards to responsible recruitment, we lose global competitiveness. And I think that's the larger scale economic argument that can be made.
Okay. All right. So let's say this unity government finally allows for refugees to work legally in the country. What are the considerations? What needs to change in terms of laws, in terms of procedures and policies, regulations, and the framework in the labor sector, Tashni?
Okay, just specifically in the labor sector, I mean, public attitudes in labor sectors and, of course, externally. There needs to be the government proactivity to want to change these things. Less sluggishness on the human rights agenda. We've seen no change in some arenas since the change in administration, which, given the promises made, could be seen from a certain point of view as regressive. Meaningful change on a large scale would be signing the Refugee Convention, enacting the domestic law. But of course, that is quite a big ask. I do understand that. So I would say that legally, a midterm and very, very, very doable thing is extending and expanding certain clauses that are already in law. So under the Immigration Act in Section 55, if anyone is very interested, the minister has discretionary power to exempt a group of people from being subjected to this law, which doesn't allow them to work, right? So there is really nothing stopping the Home Minister from saying, hey, I'm exempting the bar on work for all, you know, refugees from Syria, refugees from Myanmar. And that would be a very doable thing because it's discretionary.
Right. Help me understand why we treat refugees differently from migrant workers. Why are migrant workers allowed to work in the country as opposed to refugees?
Because they've gone through sort of, well, in theory, they've gone through an immigration system, they've spoken to middlemen, they've come in through what is considered official channels, and they have all this documentation that allows them to do so. And also there is that idea that, okay, they're going to go back after X period of time. Whereas I think there is the idea that refugees will not do so, when in fact, a lot of refugees are trying very hard to get resettled because they can't work in Malaysia, they can't access school, they can't access healthcare at, you know, the rates that Malaysians can. So no one wants to end up here.
Right. Do you know of any other countries that do allow refugees the right to work?
I would say most countries actually allow refugees the right to work. Certainly in the EU and, of course, the global north, it's actually very, very strange that Malaysia does not. We are definitely an outlier when it comes to this.
Okay, my last question to you, Tashni, is what, in your view, does meaningful change look like? And who and what will have to shift to make that happen?
So meaningful change looks like a shift in public mindsets, a shift in our proactivity on the side of lawmakers. And what would be required for this to happen is, well, for the media to take a very proactive role in not demonizing refugees. And I think all of us have seen some of the salacious headlines that come out, which use very nasty, loaded language and create this sort of us versus them mentality. And that's been very easy to do post-pandemic when people are already suffering sort of economic difficulties and things like that, right? So a huge portion of it is xenophobia. We would also have to see workplace protections strengthen. We would have to see a more robust labor economy. And we'd have to also address things like, honestly, corruption within our law. We'd have to address things like corruption within things like the police forces, who have been reported to sort of take advantage of refugees who are caught working.
Okay. Tashni, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Tashni Sukumaran, human rights consultant and researcher. We're going to take a very quick break here and consider this. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Consider This as we commemorate World Refugee Day today. Let's continue our discussion about granting refugees the right to work and gain meaningful employment. Joining us now is Tham Hui Ying. She's the Executive Director of Asylum Access Malaysia. Hui Ying, thank you for being on the show with me tonight. I understand that earlier this year, the Industrial Court of Malaysia ruled in favour of a refugee worker who filed a claim for unlawful dismissal. Now, the decision recognised the fact that the right of all workers in Malaysia, regardless of their legal status, to file a claim in the industrial court. So tell us a little bit about this case, because I understand Asylum Access Malaysia worked directly on this case. Tell me about the case and how it came to the attention of Asylum Access Malaysia.
Sure, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me here today. So maybe I'll just talk a little bit about what Asylum Access does, and then, you know, how this case came to our attention. So we are a local refugee rights organization that seeks to bring about systemic change through a combination of legal empowerment interventions and policy advocacy. And since 2017, we have actually been supporting refugees to seek redress for workplace exploitation and violations through our work rights program. And so this was how the client sort of reached out to us. The client had heard from his community leader about Asylum Access Malaysia and the services we provide in addressing violations at the workplace. And he had reached out to us directly to assist him with his case.
Okay. All right. So tell us the details of the case, if you don't mind.
Sure. So briefly the facts. So Mr. Ahmed is actually a 40-year-old refugee from Yemen. In 2011, he was forced to flee his country and he came to Malaysia to seek asylum. Like many refugees in Malaysia, you know, he was trying to make ends meet by working odd jobs to survive and support his family. And he, in fact, sort of right before the pandemic hit, was working as a distributor for a factory for 3 years. So this is until February 2020 when, you know, as we all know, the MCO came out and, he wasn't able to continue working. So at the time when he wasn't able to work, the company had already, in fact, been in arrears of his wages. And they had just issued him a notice basically saying that, like, well, you know, we can't continue working because you can't continue working because of the restrictions due to the MCO. But he was informed by his company that, you know, once, you know, the MCO is lifted and the situation allows, we will actually take you back to work. And so, of course, he was under the impression that, you know, he would have this job and that the company, I think more importantly, would pay what was due to him. However, you know, unfortunately, after the MCO had ended and, you know, the company sort of resumed operations, they did not reinstate his position. And when he tried to reach out to the employer, they basically just stopped responding to his messages and just ignored his messages and refused to pay what was owed to him. And because of that, he reached out to us trying to figure out, you know, what are some next steps he can take. My understanding is that he also attempted to file lodge a police report, but because of his status, that wasn't taken seriously. He also tried to file a complaint in the Labor Department, but again, you know, because of his refugee status, in both those situations, he basically found sort of there just wasn't any way for him to take his case further. And so he reached out to us. So we sort of assisted him in reaching out to the employer. So we basically tried to sort of clarify his status, actually wrote letters to them, asking them to officially explain what the position was. And again, of course, that was.
So help me understand, if I may just jump in here, help me understand. So we heard from Tashni Sukumaran a bit earlier, who said that refugees don't have any rights to work in the country, but they still do so in the shadow economy, work informally, informal gigs. Does the fact that refugees don't have the right to work legally, the fact that he does not, that the plaintiff did not have a work permit, if I understand correctly, how would he then, you know, seek for redress in an industrial court? Would the employment laws still apply to him?
Two things. Firstly, I think I can maybe I can talk about sort of why we can file it in the industrial court, and then maybe I can then address that second part. The first part of your question around the right to work. So it's a little bit complex. So let me just try to make sure that I'm able in my mind to like sort of break it down. So in terms of the facts of Mr. Ahmed's case, right, it's actually not like, you know, uncommon among refugee workers, right? Or workers documented or otherwise. But in terms of just refugee workers, so back in 2014, there was a case called Taj Mahal case. And actually this case basically reaffirms that position in that case. So in that case, a few things was sort of articulated by the court. So first of all, the fact that the person, so in that case, it also involved a refugee worker. The first thing that the court said was that it didn't matter that this person was a refugee, he nevertheless has the right to employment. The other things that the court said was that the right to lawful and gainful employment is a right. It falls sort of within the right to life, and sort of falls within Article 5 of the Constitution. And then the court also then said that, you know, Article 8 of the Constitution, which talks about, you know, equal protection under the law, is also something that is applicable in this case. And so ultimately the court decided in the Taj Mahal case that, you know, just because refugees are not recognized doesn't mean that they do not have the right to gain, to seek gainful employment or to avail themselves to sort of labor protections under the Industrial Relations Act or the Employment Act. And really this case is the sort of the foundation for our work rights program, right? And so it's this very interesting sort of space where, like, you technically cannot have the right to work, you don't have the legal right to work, but you do have certain labor protections. And so our position is that that needs to be, of course, implementation is a whole other question, right? Like when you don't have the legal right to work. But our position is that, like, these labor protections are available to refugees or workers, regardless of whether they're documented or not. And they should be able to seek redress in situations where they face workplace violations. So that's kind of like the basis for us this is the basis of our program, and also that's kind of like the legal position, which was affirmed in our case. So that's why we sort of, I think that's why we sort of knew that, like, you know, the industrial relations might be able to offer us the sort of outcome that we hope to seek, right? But again, with any court proceedings, nothing is a guarantee. And so I think going in there, it was like a pleasant surprise for us that, you know, the court accepted the case and was actually quite, the judge was quite empathetic in the sense that our client sort of in the middle of the proceedings was actually resettled to another country. And the judge allowed him to attend the court proceedings via teleconference. And also assured throughout the proceedings that, you know, he was comfortable. And so that was like, I mean, to us, just the totality of, you know, the proceedings and the outcome was just something that we were really, really sort of grateful for.
Well, will this decision by the industrial court, in my view, is a landmark decision, will it change things? What will it mean going forward, Huiying?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, you know, I mean, the unfortunate thing is that, like, the courts can say, it can have a particular position, but at the end of the day, it's the implementation. Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, for example, so after the order has been given, and this was back in December, so now it's been more than 6 months, the employer is well aware of the order has been served on them, but they just have not complied with the order. So, you know, as an immediate sort of like consequence, like right now, what we're trying to do is we're trying to basically enforce the order. So in terms of like changes, even something as fundamental as like the order itself, we need to kind of like initiate separate proceedings to enforce the order. They are still operating and they're just basically ignoring the court order. But, it, you know, the onus is on, in this situation, our client to follow up, and like how many people have the kind of resources and the time to be able to enforce. I mean, like taking action is one thing, but having the resources to also then sort of initiate enforcement proceedings. And so it's unfortunate that, you know, it's still like a lot of these companies are still acting with impunity, right? And I think that says a lot about, like, you know, what it means in reality, right? That like you can have this court order, you can have a very good judgment, but then, you know, until this issue of, you know, the legal right to work, and, you know, until there's any recognition, right, like of like refugees and that there is sort of protection for refugees, I mean, unfortunately, we're always going to be stuck in this limbo.
Right. In the couple of minutes that we have left, I mean, I know that the government, subsequent governments have said, many governments, iterations of governments have said that they're looking into the granting the right to work for refugees. What do you understand to be the current status? Are we any closer to seeing this materialize?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's a few things, right? I think first of all, and sorry, this is to sort of answer the earlier question that you had around the right to, or like, what does the, you know, the right to work for refugees, right? Mm-hmm. So while there isn't like a legal a law, right? Like the legal right to work, we have been told that there are sort of policies, by the National Security Council, for example, that allows them to work informally. And so if that's the case, then, you know, the position should be that they should be allowed, like, you know, they should be allowed to work, right? There should be some sort of access. So I don't think it's a matter of like, oh no, refugees don't have the right to work at all, completely. So I think you know, as you mentioned, you know, many iterations of the government have been talking about the right to work. To me, I think the important thing is sort of like the action that needs to be taken. Right. I mean, we can talk about, you know, the right to work, and we can, you know, have all these wonderful discussions about what that should look like. And, you know, but the reality is that as we're having these debates and discussions, people's livelihoods are at stake. We are talking about people who are being in recent months, for example, you know, we've been receiving a lot more reports of increase in arrests and raids at the workplace. Right. A lot of refugee workers are arrested. And of course, the difficulty here is that, you know, they are working without a legal permit. Right. And that's what they are often arrested for. And so because of that, they have been, they have been dismissed from their workplace because employers find that too much of, too much of a hassle. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen a lot of people who have become homeless, who are looking for, who are asking for basic subsistence, basic needs are not being met. We've also received reports of cases of deportations of, young asylum seekers back to Syria upon, being arrested at their workplace. So, I mean, that is the reality. That's what's happening on the ground while we're having all these discussions about the right to work. And so I think that, we need to take sort of immediate steps. So yes, if you have the commitment to implement the right to work, then take, there are immediate steps that you can take. You can ensure that, labor protections are provided, as are implemented in the ways that, they have been legislated. We can stop the rates of detention of refugee workers. We can stop depriving them of livelihood, and a dignified, we shouldn't be depriving them of, livelihood and a dignified life, right? Mm-hmm. If we've said that they can work informally, let them work informally while we're having all these discussions. I also think that it's important for us to include the voices and input of the refugees working currently, right? And their lived realities in these policies, in these laws that we're making. I think it's really important. And I think the last thing is to also think about not just the right to work, but the how. Like, so how do we implement the right to work? What does that look like? What does that framework look like? And what should it include? We need to think about not just the right to work, but the right to decent work. So ensuring that all these safeguards are in place, ensuring that there is access to work to all refugees, and there isn't too many restrictions. And I think most importantly, really tackling this issue of legal status, because until we look at the status, until we recognize refugees and provide them with the right to stay, there's always going to be pockets of people who are going to, see them as, just as undocumented workers, right? And continue to detain and deport them.
Huiying, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. Tham Huiying, the Executive Director of Asylum Access Malaysia, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.